Good afternoon, everybody. Vicious Weinberg, my father, Rabbi Mori. I just wanted to give my father just a quick introduction. And before I do that, my name is Eli Ozarowski. I just started teaching here a couple weeks ago, so I hope to get to know some of you in the future. But today, the great privilege of introducing my father, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Ozarowski, who's going to talk to us, discuss with us a little bit about conversion, about Geirus. My father has done many things over his career. He's been a pulpit rabbi in many different places. He's worked as a chaplain. He's worked as a Hebrew teacher. He's worked as the menahel of the Beis Din of the CRC, the Chicago Rabbinical Council, and he's worked as a chaplain, as the rabbi of the Jewish Family Services Agency in Chicago in the United States, many, many other things. Today, I told him that a lot of people here would be very interested in hearing some of his conversion stories from his time formerly, a couple years ago, when he was the menahel of the Beis Din of the CRC. So basically what my father's going to do is he's going to discuss with us some of the stories, some of the principles behind proper conversions, how they're done, how they should be looked at by Rabbanim, how a Beis Din looks at them, some of the problems that go into it, some of the things that a rabbi who is interviewing prospective candidates should do, some things that they shouldn't do, etc., etc. This is going to be very, very open. So my father will talk, but everybody's welcome. Please, you know, more than welcome and encouraged to ask questions and to dialogue, to discuss, and hopefully we'll be able to learn a lot and gain a lot together.
Thank you, Rav Eli, for that lovely introduction.
I forgot one point also. My father also happens to have be a published author. He's published two books over his lifetime. One is about the halacha and psychology of Bikur Cholim and Avelus, called To Walk in God's Ways. And another one he co-authored called Common Ground, which is a discussion on the parsha between different rabbis, both Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, on different issues in Parashat HaShavua.
I was the Orthodox one.
Yeah. Hope that was self-explanatory.
I hope so.
Just to move over to your left a little bit.
The
camera will cut you better that way without the people behind you.
First,
menu.
The rabbi.
Oh, very good. Right, I'm going to be kind of jumping around a little bit. Sometimes I get up and stand up. Sometimes I walk around. Sorry, I got to be careful, huh? How much time do we have, just so I know the time?
I thought till about 4:30, but 4:30. Whatever. Okay. You know, people can leave in the middle if you need to, or if we want to go on.
Very good. Anyway, I want to thank you and the yeshiva for inviting me to join you today. I've actually been in this ezor a lot of times. I have another son, Rav Eli's brother, lives just on two hills away from here in Alon Shvut, but I've never been in Shivat HaMivtar, so it's really a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for inviting me. What we're going to do is have a conversation, although I'm going to be talking during a lot of the conversation, but I don't anticipate me talking for an hour and a quarter straight. I want to go around the table a little bit, and I'd like to ask all of you, in a sentence or two, max, tell me your names. Don't test me on it, but tell me your names. Tell me where you're from, what you hope to be doing after you're out of here, and what brought you to this particular shir. Sentence or two. Let's over here.
My name is Olaf. I grew up in South Africa, but I studied in America in college. I'd like to start a business once I'm out of yeshiva. Mm-hmm. What brought me to the show?
Yep.
Well, it was a Naz. I thought it was quite an interesting topic.
Okay. Thank you.
Gabriel Reese from Los Angeles originally. I'm studying in the Kollel here. And also,
it
was announced, and I wanted to
hear
what you had to say.
Thank you.
I'm Moshe Pfeiffer. I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
I've heard of it.
Many years ago. I'm finishing Shiva this year and hope to be servicing as some sort of Jewish education, rabbinical capacity next year, overseas if I found a job.
Good. Good.
Ed Zinkin, originally from London. Long time I used to be a pulpit rabbi, and I can share because I have a number of friends who converted to the CRC.
Oh.
So I heard their stories.
We may have some of the same stories, actually, but from a different angle. You'll see if what I tried to do was what they really wanted, or we'll see if it was good.
Nachum Weinberg, teach here, and I'm involved in preparing a few felt we have here. from a number of different countries for you.
Hi, Friedman. Originally from California, been in Israel for a while, and instead of working, I decided to come to Yeshiva for a few years.
It's work too.
Hello, Moore. Originally from Wellington, New Zealand. I hope to be working with Jewish communities internationally or even here in Israel, especially in and
Hill has a website.
I do.
About helping converts, potential converts, through the process.
You do?
Yeah.
That's
a good one.
It's not
the
website.
Say the website.
Very
good. Like a really good place now.
I'm Pinchas Punturello from Italy. I served the Jewish community there for a couple of years. I'm here to study, to go back to Italy, Bezrat Hashem, to serve as educator or rabbi. And I study with Rabbi Ravelli. And I'm also in Amiel, where we study a lot about Giur, or whatever, so I was interested to have another point of view. Not just South America or Italy or Spain or whatever.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm David, and I'm from Northern Virginia. And
where in Northern Virginia?
Burke, Fairfax County.
Oh my goodness. My sister lives very close to there.
Oh, really?
She's in Fairfax Station, one of those developments there.
Oh, okay.
Like 5 minutes from the auto train.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You've been to Malky, Ann Malky's house, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
A small little apartment.
I just want to be a good Jew when I leave.
Amen. That's good. That's the best aspiration anybody can have, really. Good Jew and a good person, and, you know, can't do more than that. Good. Shkoyach.
My name is Noach Davidovich. I was born in Denver, Colorado. Grew up in Efrat. Living here, I also want to be a good Jew like him. Interested in Rebbe's Shir.
Thank you. Thank you.
My name is Nathan Tara. I'm originally from Paris, France. And I'm a musician. I'm a convert myself, so that's why I'm interested. Unfortunately, I have to pick up the door. Telegraph's open day.
Okay. Gotta do what you gotta do. Well, I'm delighted all of you came to spend the time with me, and we'll learn a little bit together. Let me tell you what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do. This will not primarily be a shiur in halacha. That was never the intent. I will be referencing certain halachot, but frankly, I didn't prepare for that today, and frankly, it wasn't my specialty when I was doing the work. Not that I wasn't knowledgeable in it. You have to be to do the work that I was doing. But I'll tell you what it's based on. Rav Eli gave you a little introduction. I spent 4.5 years as the executive director of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, the CRC. I came to Chicago for that. That was between exactly February 01, we came back to Chicago, and I left that job in 05, in June of 05, and I went full-time into pastoral work, the work that I'm doing now, which... The CRC is a great organization. I'm still a member, and in fact, my father-in-law, Ravelli's grandfather, was a past president and member of the Beit Din, so our family has some very deep ties to the CRC. I did a lot of interesting things for the CRC, a lot of mostly administrative things, because that's what a rabbinical organization needs to have, and so you know, the budget has to be there, and the committees have to function. There's a ton of paperwork. But one of the most interesting things, one of the things I actually missed the most about the CRC is the Geirut program, which I administered. The reason I'm not going to deal with halacha is because we have a world-class posek in Chicago, a name that might be familiar to some of you, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who is not only the Av Beit Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, but the Av Beit Din of the Beit Din of America, which is the Beit Din of the Histadrut HaRabbanim and co-sponsored by the Orthodox Union. It is the major Beit Din for, let's call it, mainstream orthodoxy. I don't know what modern orthodox means anymore, but whatever we're calling ourselves nowadays, that's the Beit Din for us in America. And so that's his position, and I was his Masharis for 4.5 years, one of the great perks of the job, so I learned a lot from him. I will be referencing his shitot on a number of things, partly because he's been my posek for 25, 30 years, even before he came to Chicago. And partly because a lot of it is just so very, very sensible and just makes so much, it just mistaber, you'll see it makes a lot of sense. The Chicago template for conversion actually was a really good one. And in fact, it was the model for what the Rabbinical Council of America developed in what is now called the GPS system. GPS not referring to what you keep in your car, but I think it stands for Geirut Protocols and something or other. I forget what the S stands for, but you get the idea. It's a national system of Batei Din that the RCA developed in America to centralize procedures for Giur, not without some controversy. In fact, it was done when the Israeli Rabbanut started giving the American Rabbanut a very, very hard time. Whether that was the right reason for doing it is another question. I won't get into the politics of that today. Unless you take me in that direction, but I wasn't planning on that. But the idea itself is a good idea, that the rules are out there, the expectations are out there, and there are addresses that people can go to when they want to come under Kanteh Shechina. I mean, that's just the way to do it. I'm not going to get into, at least not in a big way, the major question of what defines Geirut Halacha. There's a multi-way machloket. One of the best articles on the subject was written by Rav Michael Broyd, a name that might be familiar to some of you. Rav Broyd is a member of the RCA Beit Din. He's also a professor of law at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And he was a shul rav. He's now emeritus because he really liked teaching more than the pulpit, but he's had that experience as well. And he wrote an article in, I think it was Tradition, which is the RCA's Jewish Thought Journal, a couple of years ago. He kind of goes through all the different shitot. He has his own approach, of course. But basically one of the core questions which people are yelling and screaming about nowadays is, you know, what is the meaning of Kabbalat HaMitzvot? Is it some vague general acceptance? Does it mean accepting all the mitzvot? Does it mean you have to actually keep them before? Does it mean you have to keep them afterwards? I'm not going to get into that in detail. But I will tell you about what we did, how Rav Schwartz defined it, and how we did it operationally, and what my own role in all this was. As the Menahel, I didn't paskin the shilas at all. That was Rav Schwartz's. But we also had a committee that was involved that actually had to decide. The committee was not necessarily the Beit Din, although people often identified them with each other. The committee was a committee of local Rabbanim who were willing to vet potential converts that came through the CRC's way. If I had to sum up what the CRC used to look for, I'd say there were four things that we looked for, at least in the process and towards the end of the process. One was, and I'm speaking actually when I rewrote the protocols, the CRC had been doing it for many, many years. In my first year, I rewrote the whole protocols. I didn't make major changes, and I cleared it with the Rav and the Geirut Committee, but I thought it needed to be better organized, and this is how I organized it. Number one, emunot. There are certain basic beliefs that a Jew who wants to join the Jewish people under halachic auspices, which is how we've always believed it's been, how it's always been, has to have. And I think you can know these as much as I do. I don't have to go over with you, but emunah Hashem, Torah miSinai, the binding authority of halacha, emunah chachamim, which is not the same as das Torah, and I'm not going to touch that question today either, but emunah chachamim in terms of how the sages passed down the tradition, the Kedusha of Am Yisrael. We are a Zionist organization, and so we believe Medinat Yisrael. It's in there. We are able to do that and get away with it, frankly, considering where things are going in some places. That's part of what we do as well. So certain basic emunot. The next, of course, is mitzvot. We want to see a practice of a mitzvah-oriented life, an acceptance of halacha. We didn't demand that every ger has to know every dikduke halacha that exists out there, because that's impossible. And I'm going to flesh that out a little bit more as we go along. The third piece is knowledge, that to live a Jewish life, you have to have a very basic knowledge, a very important basic knowledge of the essentials of Judaism. And that comes through reading and learning, and we had a very extensive reading list. I probably still have it online at home. If you wanted, I could probably send it to you. That's probably changed in the last 6 years, but it's still the same principle. And connections with teachers. So every candidate had to have a sponsoring rabbi, and I'll tell you more about that as well. And then there was a fourth thing that was kind of unique, which we always had, but I felt rather strongly about it, and Rav Schwartz agreed with me and the committee agreed with me, and that is socialization. That even if you have all the best beliefs, a frumi yid, and you do it all. And even if you're medaktik and you're keeping halacha and it's all there, and even if you've studied and learned and sat in the Beis Medrash, if you're not part of a community, a living Torah community, it isn't going to work. And this is part of my own pastoral training, my own training in pastoral psychology, in relationships, that when you don't have socialization, you have automatically lowered the chances that the Kabbalah is going to stick. Now, of course, no Beit Din can guarantee that a Kabbalah will stick, although what's going on with the Rabbanut here and other, I mean, that's part of what they're yelling and screaming about. But the fact is, nobody can guarantee it. What you want to do is up the odds. And that was part of how we organized our program. So let me tell you about some of the initial things that we looked for in the process, and then some of the specifics that you'll find interesting, and then by all means, if you have questions, I'm happy to have conversations and jump in and just raise your hand and we'll talk. Klal number one in this process is we treated people respectfully. We treated people, or let me rephrase it, we tried our best to treat people with respect. There were times when people felt that we didn't treat them with respect. And it could be we had made mistakes. We tried our best not to, but there are often other issues. I got one or two good trench stories that will illustrate that point where it wasn't really because of us. But people come for Geirut for a lot of reasons. In fact, let me go off on a tangent very, very briefly. I know Rabbi Riskin has talked about this. I've heard him firsthand actually talk about this. But I have a somewhat different twist on the same point. I'm not suggesting we change the halacha at all. I'm not suggesting that we be proactive about searching for Geirut. But I will tell you this, based on my experience in the field and my being in the pulpit rabbinate for a long, long time and running this program for 4.5 years, there's actually a hunger for spirituality out there. And I don't know if it's as true in other parts of the world as it is in North America. So it could be this isn't true in places like Italy or New Zealand or France. I don't know the realities there, and you can teach me about that. But in the United States, and I think in Canada as well, there is a tremendous hunger for spirituality. People are looking for a lot of the things that we have to offer. We could actually increase, Jewish numbers were we to be proactive. I'm not suggesting that we do that. I think there are dangers in that, and there are a lot of good reasons not to do it, and to keep the halakha as it is, and we don't have the authority to do it anyway, so it's kind of moot. But my point is that knowing the zeitgeist out there, it's out there. There are people looking. So, having said that, we treated people with respect. What about the point you're supposed to turn people away? All right? There's a way to do it. And we built that into the system. Rather than saying, feh, get out of here, I don't want to talk to you. You're crazy. Who wants to? We never did that. We never did that at all. We questioned them. But we built several safeguards into the system. The first was a very lengthy application, 15 pages. We wanted them to write. Not just to discourage them, although that was certainly part of the thinking, but we wanted to know who they were. And that gets to my fourth point about socialization and the psychology behind it. We wanted to get to know, who are they? Why are they coming? What's behind it? What's going on there? And we charged a $100 application fee. We raised it from 25 to 100. 25 just seemed too easy. If somebody really wants to become a Jew, we didn't need the money. We have a very extensive kashrut supervision system. It pays for a lot of kehilas shezachin. We didn't need the money, believe me. But we thought it was important that if somebody wants to engage in this route, they have to make a commitment. We wouldn't even talk to them, other than the most basic issues, before we got the application and the fee. Because there was really nothing to say. I would answer some basic questions, and what's it like, and how do you do it? But, before we could actually begin to have the dialogue with them, we had to make certain demands. You had a question, or you looked like you had a question.
How long did the whole process
take? I'll get to that, because the process hasn't even started yet, okay? The process cannot even start until we get the application and the fee, okay? We want to see a commitment, to see some seriousness of commitment before we would even consider talking to them. Otherwise, we'd be wasting our... We had dozens and dozens, hundreds over the years, I was there, of people who were interested, but who were clueless as to what this was. They saw a TV show. Oh, Jews are cool. I want to be a Jew too, I went to my best friend's kid's bar mitzvah. I want a bar mitzvah too. We get things like that all the time. These are not people who are serious about Judaism. They don't know, So that was really the first part of the step. Once we got the application, we acknowledged the application, and then we waited for them to make the initial appointment. We were not proactive. That's how we were not proactive. They had to call me to make the initial application. I was the gatekeeper. My role was the gatekeeper. Didn't pass the halacha, didn't make the final decision, didn't make any decisions, frankly, but I was the gatekeeper. So once we have the application, and I got to read it, and I said, I got to know a little bit of who they are and where they're coming from, then they want to talk, we invite they call me, we invite them for an initial meeting with me, and just with me. And I saved the committee a lot of tircha because I was able to vet the ones who were not that serious or were coming from, you know, another planet, as opposed to the ones who actually, well, there's something to talk about here. And that doesn't mean they had to know anything. We didn't demand the base of knowledge before they started the system. We assumed they didn't know much. I mean, some came actually with knowledge. And then there's some special cases that I do want to talk about in terms of Jews who were already in significant relationships, non-Jews, I'm sorry, who were in significant relationships with Jews. That's a related but separate category, and I will talk about that before today's over. It's an important category. In fact, there were times when we had more of them than people coming, you know, out of, you know, totally out of someplace else who came to us. I will talk about that. That's, in some ways, I think, even a bigger issue. I'll tell you how we handled it. If I felt that these people were stable and, you know, focused, and that was a really big part of it. I'll tell you one case that I have right now that I'm working with. I serve, Ravelli didn't mention this, but I actually keep a finger in the pulpit. Even though I have my day job is with Jewish Child and Family Services, I'm the chaplain for them, and I do a lot of pastoral work. I have a little shul in Minneapolis I serve once a month.
It's on the board.
Oh, it's on the board, okay. So I have a little shul in Minneapolis I serve once a month. I don't do Geirut for them because I'm not able to. Once a month is not enough time to do the kind of mentoring that is necessary to bring somebody tachat kanfei hashchina. You need to have that kind of mentoring. If you're planning on doing Geirut, when you get out in the field, wherever you're going, you'll need to commit time and effort and energy to make it right and to make it proper. I'm not even talking about the halacha here. I'm talking about the process and the socialization here. That's really important. So I can't do it. But I get the questions. And I have one person who is hanging around our shul who I would say this, I'm not going to say, you know, who the person is or even if the person's a male or female. That wouldn't be right. And I have to keep some confidentiality here. But the person, while I actually had a conversation with them, and I would have sent them to a rabbi who would have taken them to the CRC, because that's how I would have done it. And I would have played second chair, and I still might do that. But this person was, in terms of the emunot, I saw no problem. In terms of shmirat ha-mitzvot, this person seemed to be knowledgeable and really wanted to keep everything. But I got the feeling the person was a lost soul and had nothing better to do. Like the person had no life. No job, no life, no social life, no friends, no nothing. Now, does this mean it can't work? I don't know. I can't say. It's a kind of a red flag that I thought of. We don't turn people like that away. We want to sort of gear them in the right direction and see if they can, you know, we'll open the door for them, they have to walk through the door themselves. And I'm giving you process-oriented things. So that's a case that's still pending, and the person actually, I mean, I coached them a little bit, but I said, I can't teach you, you have to find another teacher. The person found another rabbi, and they had their first meeting with the CRC, and we'll see where it goes. If I felt after the first meeting there was something to talk about here, I would share then the application with the members of the Geirut Committee. Rav Schwartz is a member of the committee, he's not the chair of the committee. If there's a specific issue of halacha, we all defer to him. But in terms of the committee meeting, he's just a member of the committee, maybe the, you know, first among seniors, but, and he treated us that way. He treated us as equals. We were all Rabbonim, and he treated us as Rabbonim. That's why it made it so nice to work in this process. But the committee has a chair, and I was the staff member. I was the administrator. So at the first meeting, if we would invite them to the first meeting, we would then interview them, and the committee would decide, are we ready to accept this person as a candidate for Geirut? And we would ask them questions and see what they would say. And if we felt that they had all the things in place, then we would accept them as a candidate. Now to answer the question, how long does it take from the beginning of candidacy to, you know, the end when the successful candidate finishes and goes to the mikvah, it's about a year in Chicago. Sometimes more, sometimes a little less, rarely a lot less. Unless there are special cases, and there were some special cases, there still are actually, and I'll get to those. But we felt you need a full year to gain the body of knowledge to allow you to walk out of the mikvah and keep a basically orthodox life. to develop a relationship with a Rav, and that is absolutely essential. Every candidate had to have a sponsoring rabbi. They often came to the first meeting without a rabbi, and I would say, it sounds like you have, you know, a lot going on here and maybe good, but without a rabbi, we cannot process you further. Find yourself a rabbi. Who's the rabbi? Well, I don't know. Where do you live? I looked at the application. It depends on what neighborhood they would live in. They would sometimes, if they would live in a neighborhood with a CRC member or someone that we would accept, we said, go here, here are a couple of rabbis, check up with them, and if they accept you as a sponsoring rabbi, then that will cover that part of it. Sometimes they had to find somebody not in their neighborhood. And in fact, part of the socialization process was that we would, an absolute demand is that they had to be in walking distance of an Orthodox synagogue. Not at the first step necessarily, but somewhere along the middle of the way, they had to be in walking distance of a shul. Partly for reasons of halacha, how can Bishomer Shabbos not a shul to go to? And if you're driving to shul, that'll have to stop. And partly because of the socialization factor. You got to be part of a community. How can we strongly believed, we still do, CRC still believes, that you can't really assimilate all this information and the lifestyle and the practices without being part of a living community. So that was an absolute. Not at the beginning necessarily. At some point, probably by the second meeting, and the sponsoring rabbi's recommendation that they're ready for it, we would say, well, are they in walking distance of the shul now? If they were, then they're ready for a second meeting. If not, we'd say, let's wait. Or if there were outside factors, there were all, you know, all sorts of different things. Everybody's story is different. Everybody has a different story. And we took those into consideration. But at some point, they had to be in walking distance of the shul. So we would work with them, but we couldn't. We didn't do the mentoring or the teaching. That's where the sponsoring rabbi comes in. It was the sponsoring rabbi's job to mentor them and, if needed, get them tutors, if the sponsoring rabbi couldn't do it himself, for learning basic Yiddishkeit. The belief system, of course, practical halacha, and the things that a Jew needs to live. Now, if you know the basic halacha, you know what the Rambam says, you know what the Shulchan Aruch says, it's mitzvahs and mitzvahs. All right? A selection of the mitzvahs. Kalos and chamurot. Kalot and chamurot. Okay? Rav Schwartz defined mitzvah ha-mitzvot as Shabbat, Kashrut, and Tarat HaMishpacha. Those were the three basics. Okay? That by the end of the process, the person had to be a Shomer Shabbat, had to be a Shomer Kashrut, and if they were married, they had to keep Tarat HaMishpacha, male or female. That was essential. They also had to know enough Hebrew to be able to function in an Orthodox shul. You got to daven. They don't have to be experts on any of these things. They have to know enough that when they walk out of the mikveh, they can put up, they can have a Shomer Shabbos home, kosher home, Taras Mishpacha, and be able to function in a shul, to walk into a shul. They don't have to daven quickly. In fact, we were often inspired by the Geirim who actually davened with great kavana, and we're saying, you know, Ashi Yoshev, and we're rattling off the words, and they're actually davening seriously. We often told these stories amongst ourselves, and we told it to them too, how they inspired us, the ones who really did it right. And the basis of basic Jewish knowledge, and we had a book list. I should go back a step. When I had them at the first meeting, if they hadn't done it yet, there were three books that I would recommend. In fact, at the first meeting, I would say, if I felt that they weren't, you know, far enough to invite back, I would say, there are three books I want you to read. I want you to read them twice. The first book is Donan's book, To Be a Jew, which is, while it's kind of dry in its writing style, it's still probably the best overall introduction to Halachic Judaism in all its different ways. That's number one. The second one was Maurice Lamb's book, Becoming a Jew, which is about Geirut. It's thick, but it's very good. And the third one was a Blue Greenberg's book, to How to Run a Traditional Jewish Household, which is a really good introduction to what goes on in a home. Those are my three favorites. There are others too, and other people might have others. Those are the ones I said, read it twice. I said, read it, first of all, for the knowledge. Then read it again to decide if this is the way you want to live your life. Because a lot of them came not knowing. And this is one of the ways that I was able to sort of be mevarer between the ones who would be serious and the ones who didn't. When they see what's demanded of them and what the type of lifestyle we're talking about, they may have second thoughts about it. If they came back to me and said, yeah, I really, that's how I see my future. That's where I want to be. That's the relationship I want to have with God. That's the relationship I want to have with Jewish people. That's how I want to live my life. Then they were pretty close to being ready to be invited for the meeting, the first meeting with the Geirut committee. That's how we did it. it's a tahalich, but it was a very sensible tahalich. So we had our book list, of course. We treated them with respect at every step of the way. We also explained, I certainly tried to explain what would be expected of them. We didn't want to foist them with surprises, which is why reading the books in advance was really very, very important to them. Along the way, I want to talk about this for a minute, and then we'll have some time for questions. Well, I'll tell some of the stories first. Along the way, the Shita of Rav Gedalia Schwartz is based on a tshuva from Rav Shmuel Salant, and I can't tell you where it is, but offhand at least, but he was very clear. Rav Schwartz felt strongly, I might add, that somebody who's been accepted by the Gerut Committee as a candidate is already in a different status than a non-Jew. They're not a Jew, but they've been, the term he used was poresh midat acheret. They have separated themselves from another religion by the fact that they have chosen to go this path and willing to put up with the stuff that we threw at them, and it's a lot to ask for. And I'll give you actually, there's actually two nafkaminas on this particular point that I want to point out to you. These things do come out. Nafkamina number one. The question, here's a question halacha, which I won't paskin for, but I'll tell you how it plays out in this. Are you allowed to invite a non-Jew to a yontif meal? The Shabbos, it's not such an issue, but yontif, the whole heter of cooking, of bishul, is based on what? What's it based on? What's it? It's like Ochel Nefesh. Ochel Nefesh for another Jew who's celebrating Yom Tov, which is why it's problematic. I won't say it's Usser, because they're Heterim. That's right, that's right. But you're not allowed to cook for a non-Jew on Yom Tov. Are there ways to do it? Yes, there are. We're not going to get into the ways you can do that today. I grew up in a home that was not frum, but traditional, and we always had guests on Yom Tov. My parents always had non-Jewish guests on Yom Tov. So I grew up being used to that. But that's not what we're going to get into today. Schwartz held that it is not only permissible, but laudatory to invite Gerut candidates, people who've been accepted in the program, to Yontif meals, because how else are they going to learn how to do Yontif? And they're in a different category. They're not a non-Jew anymore. They're not a Jew. They're in this kind of in-between state. Poresh midat acheret. So that's one klal that was very clear in how we did things based on Rav Schwartz's psak. There's a second, and this I'm going to tell you one of my favorite stories. Okay, we're going to start with the stories now. We had a case of an older woman, 80-plus-year-old woman, came to me asking about conversion. Why would an 81-year-old woman want to convert? Frail. It turns out that her son actually converted many years back and was living as a frum Jew in Chicago. She wanted to be buried with him. And she was a very sweet woman, kind of a very pushness, very, very simple, but she was willing to do and accept whatever she needed to accept. And she was willing to live the life that her son lived. I won't give you all the details of how this came about. And she was willing to do it. And we weren't sure, can we accept such a case? Number one, mentally, is she able to absorb the amount of knowledge? Number two, physically, can she even go to the mikveh? She was pretty frail. We agonized over this. We decided to accept her as a candidate because we felt that she's meeting the standards. The emunah was there, the desire was there, she lived in the community, she had a son who was a frum yid, and family that was frum. We said, let's help her along and see how it develops. She died before she could complete the process, and Rav Schwartz allowed her Kvurat Yisrael in a separate section of the cemetery, but not totally removed, because he felt that she was no longer a non-Jew. She wasn't a Jew. She couldn't be buried right among other Jews, but he allowed her to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. Nafkamina lahalacha. That was our Schwartz. And that was how we operated things. That's how we did it.
Did you already, I've seen Jews that have, if somebody went through part of the process, but they did come out mitzvot, but didn't do tevilah. They're still allowed. They're allowed to be buried in the Jews.
Yeah, yeah. It was based in part on that. Although she was at a slightly, in other words, whether she was mekabel the mitzvot or not, that was never clear to me. But I think Rav Schwartz gave her the benefit of the doubt because she came with such, simple emuna. So I think he allowed it. I think he built that into it when he made this psak for the family. So yeah, yeah.
I have a different question. Doesn't the application process, knowing what it includes, is already a partially a kabbalah mitzvot. Even though without the knowledge, but it's a Kabbalah mitzvot. I'm willing to go through this process. I don't know exactly what it entails, but Begadol, I'm Mekabel. If, you know, at this point, I'm Mekabel with the, like, I want to be Mekabel the mitzvot. That's why I'm going through the process in the first place.
So Rav Uziel's approach is a much more lenient approach. You've probably heard of this approach, where, you know, a basic Kabbalah is all you need without knowing all the details. Rav Schwartz has respect for Rav Uziel, but he is a bit stricter, but not... I'll tell you what Rav Schwartz says. Basically, he holds that the idea of Kabbalah is that by the time you end the process, if you do it right, then it's not a difficult thing to accept the mitzvot. And in the mikvah, Schwartz had a routine, and the routine is scripted. I mean, I can say to you it's scripted. It's not scripted the ger. But basically, by the time they're standing in the mikvah, you know, you better know the right answers to these questions. And the questions are, do you believe in God? Do you accept the Torah, the written law and the oral law as passed down by the sages? Believe in Schar V'Onesh. He's following a script that's in Chazal, that's in the poskim, and, you know, and if the answers to these questions aren't yes, we have a big problem. By the time you get to this point, if you've done it right, with mentoring, with socialization, with learning, with all this stuff, then it's not difficult for the candidate to say absolutely without question, because we hope that it's worked at that point. So, yeah. By that point, now, Rav Schwartz felt that a ger doesn't have to know every little bit of the halacha. You got to know the basics. And the idea is, part of the Kabbalah, as Rav Schwartz defined it, was that as you keep learning more, you will be accepting more. The key is raising the bottom level of where they're coming from when they enter the Jewish people. That it's not a lower bottom, it's a higher bottom. That they come with knowledge and socialization and a rav and relationships and all these things. That's the difference. That's why we made it a little bit. That was, I think, the chiddush that we offered to this whole process. And if you're going to be in a small town in Western Europe, let's say, I know I was speaking to a friend of Rav Eli's, where he lives, who was a Rav in Western Europe, and he had difficulties.
He studied here.
And he's talking about difficulties where he didn't have the, so there wasn't really from people, there weren't really from people to associate with. And when you're in a Western European community, which is funded by the government from people's taxes, and you got to do what they say because it's government. It's, in America, you wouldn't have that because the church and state are separated. I can't paskin for him, but it's a difficult situation. I would say if you're in a situation, a small community in Italy or New Zealand or wherever you might end up, let's say, it's important for it to work. If you don't have religious people in your own community, then number one, that makes your job much, much, I won't say harder, but much more busy, but you have to do it because you're the frum community. And you should definitely require, this is just my opinion here, but I think I'm speaking on the basis, you should require that they spend time in other communities where there are frum people that spend Shabbos and Yom Tov with. And that's doable, by the way. I mean, now that Chabad's all, I'm not advocating Chabad here, so there are other issues with Chabad and whether Mishachistim or not, but there are enough places wherever you are that you can find, they have to travel for it, but it should be a requirement because the socialization is really important. If they don't have relationships, people who are role models for them, it ain't going to work. It just isn't going to work. So I feel very strongly about that, and I know that Rav Schwartz feels strongly about that. We all did, which is why we made it such a point. Now, in Chicago, it was relatively easy. There are choice of religious neighborhoods, and if they weren't in one, they eventually have to move into one. And at some point, he said, you got to show us that you're serious about this because you're still out in your chuppets or wherever they were. You can't be Robinson Crusoe and be, you know, you can in theory be an Orthodox Jew and Robinson Crusoe, but if you're MacGyver, it doesn't work. We wouldn't accept it. We would not accept it. And we did get questions. I remember one case from, it was actually from Minnesota, the wild woods of Minnesota. They were living, it was an intermarriage, and I'll talk about that in a minute. They were living a frum life. They were Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus. We told them, unless you find a way to spend most of your Shabbos in a community, we can't proceed with it. We felt that was really important. There were some comments and questions. Yes?
Well, at the beginning you said that there's a tremendous thirst for spirituality among the non-Jewish population. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you pointed out that there's a problem to allow everyone to join the Jewish people. So my question is about the option of Bnei Noach or Yirei Hashem. Is there, number one, awareness of this possibility? Number two, if there's awareness, are there informal or formal structures that are in place to allow for these people who are looking for guidance from the Jewish people to live a spiritual life? But, and I don't know that that's what Hashem demands of them, that they should keep Tayag Mitzvot. Do we have any awareness of this in the Jewish community of a possibility like that?
It's a good question. I can answer most of that. I can respond to most of that. I used to use that very, very line, actually, in some of the early stages there when I felt that they may not be good candidates for conversion, but they had something going on there, and that was sincere and genuine. I said, we actually need, you know, we need more good non-Jews than Jews at this point. I would use that line. And I advised, being a Ben Noach, we talked about what that meant. Is there a formal structure? Not to the best of my knowledge. Are there informal structures? Actually, there are. Go online, you will find there are communities of Bnei Noach in some odd places, Tennessee. There's a story of a church, where was it? Near Chattanooga, somewhere in central eastern Tennessee, which the pastor decided that he wasn't ready to convert, but he wanted to live a life like the Bible, like God wanted him to. He became a Ben Noach, and he took a large chunk of his church with him. It's a Ben Noach. They don't call themselves a church anymore. They're not Christians. They're Bnei Noach. There are a number of, I don't know if it's a formal network. I haven't tracked it in the last 5 years. I shouldn't say not. They may have gotten together.
I know of a couple of networks.
There are in a few places. If you go online, you can find them, of people who are genuinely formal Bnei Noach. Can someone be an informal Ben Noach? Possibly. But in terms of the formal structure, there are small clusters of different places. And we often recommended better to go that route. We felt it wasn't appropriate to proceed. So that's a very good question. We were not in a position to foster communities of Bnei Noach. That's a big undertaking. You'd need a retired rabbi who's got a lot of time. Most Rabbanim are so busy with Kehilisha stuff. You know, you're busy with your Kehilah. You know, you're busy teaching and preaching and kids and Geirut of people who are becoming formal Jews. Who has time for Bnei Noach? But there's actually a need out there.
I think there is a Rav here in Eretz Yisrael that works on this. Not Rabbi, what's his name? Rabbi Schwartz.
That could be.
You know, I forgot his first name. What's his name?
Richmond? Chaim Richmond?
No, it's not.
And also Rabbi Sherky. I mean, the organizations that are beginning.
I see.
Is,
so I thought there was
Moss
another one.
Has a whole, yeah. But they do have a whole behind a 7 for 70 campaign. No, they do. They put out ads. There's the Vandal Jones...
Yeah, Vandal Jones, who was the model for Indiana Jones, by the way.
Memory.
It's true, it's true.
He had all the elements, right. He never converted.
Yeah.
His kids did, though.
Interesting, that's very, I didn't hear, that I didn't hear, that I didn't hear, that's very, very interesting.
I have a question, Rob.
Yeah.
What about the community? How do they accept the new dream? I mean, there's no racism, or there's no problem, because we have also we are talking about strategization of these people, but sometimes, apart from the problem of the how can they find the religious model in small communities where there's no people that are observant or whatever, but how the community accept that, because agar is always sometimes also a question for a community, because sometimes in a small community where the people are not observant and the agar is much more observant is a problem for their identity.
That's a good
I don't know, other kind of problem.
That's a good question. I'll tell you, I can't speak globally on this. If you talk to Gayrim, and I have, there are mixed reviews on that question. Some communities are more accepting than others, and some have had very, very tough times being accepted. In my own experience in Chicago and in the Midwest, I'd say some communities were better than others, and more often, those were the communities where we got more candidates. In other words, in Chicago, so you have a couple of very intense communities, West Rogers Park, Skokie. We did not get that many candidates. We got very few from West Rogers Park, and we got a few from Skokie. We got more of them from places like Lakeview, which is in the city, which has a huge single scene and a huge young couple scene, kind of like the Upper West Side of New York, if you know New York at all. We got a lot of them from there. We got candidates in the university communities like Evanston and Northwestern. We got candidates from near the University of Chicago, Hyde Park. We had a Rav who was the Hill director out there, was an Orthodox Rav. Some of the Chabad Chevra, we took in some of the Chabad. The non-Mashichist Chabad Chevra joined the CRC, the ones who were actually in full-time, you know, Chabad communities. They sent us their people. And we got people from all over the Midwest. There are certain communities. Indianapolis was one. Minneapolis, in fact, my shul in Minneapolis, we have a whole group of Gary Tzedek who were converted by a very early predecessor. They're the best people in the shul. Okay? I have to tell you. So in communities like that, they're totally accepted, completely accepted. But in some of the more intense communities, it can be a problem. And there's a lot of educating that needs to be done. And when we got a candidate like that with a rav from that community, we had to mentor the rav, saying, you know, you have to make a point of making sure that they feel welcome and that they can learn what they need to learn. And then when they've become successful candidates, that they're fully accepted, because that's what the halacha requires, and that's what basic menschlichkeit requires. Come on, you know, they're Jews, and you can't just discriminate. You can't. So we, there was a lot of educating that we had to do, and we demanded a lot of the local rav. Because ultimately we are just sort of a processing agency. We have a talich, but we don't do the conversion for them, but we don't mentor them. We can't, you know, we're not on the spot with them. We're not in their community. Let's see. Speaking of Chabad, I had one really interesting Chabad case. I'll tell you what we did. I won't tell you what community this person was from. It was from a Chabad community. Let's just say somewhere in the Midwest, where the gentleman came to us. In the whole Chabad costume, you know, Chabad with the beard and the long coat, he found out, he was not a rav, he was just a balabas who was part of Chabad. He found out at some point that his mother was not Jewish. His mother had a Reform conversion. Never knew. Now, and he was like really distraught and upset and just didn't know what to do. We were very gentle and kind with him. But there was one important caveat we said to him. We said everything I've outlined to you before. We went through all this, but he had opened up like a Chabad house of his own, and we had people over for Shabbos. Was trying to be makari of them. He said, "You know something? Back off just a little bit. We it's wonderful to be makari of Jews, but until your personal status is resolved, just don't try to be makari of other people. Just do what you can do. You're so Hashem, you get to that point." You can go out and be Makari people, but we told them, don't be so much of a Chabadnik in that sense while you're going through the process. And so he actually became a very successful Geret Tzedek, I would say. And he did it our way. He did back off. We actually made an absolute demand. We said, we're not going to process if you don't do it. Because he was in a different world. And you can't be in that world when you're in process. Let's talk a little bit about two cases. One are Jews who always thought they were Jewish, and then found out that they weren't. That, for the CRC, that was always kind of a separate category. The halacha doesn't change. The halacha still requires what it requires, but the process changes because they're not being poresh midat acheret, because they never believed in another religion. They always thought they were Jews. We gave people like that special consideration, especially if they were already living a frum life, and they just discovered that there was a problem, we would often give them kind of a fast track. You know, if we were convinced that they were in a situation, we had people who came to Chicago to learn, to go to yeshiva, who were in communities doing other things, and if they were living from like just this, it was technicality, we would still, you know, have them go through like a facsimile of the process. We would still charge them for the initial application, and we would still want the initial application, but we might not make it take a year. We might then have one meeting, and assuming everything was in place, we would do the gevurah the same day for them, because they never had another religion. If they weren't religious, we would want them to live a Torah life, and then we'd want them to go through the process. And we would support them. We wouldn't try to push them away as much, because there's nothing to push away there. They always thought they were Jewish. We don't need to discourage them. They never thought they weren't anything but Jewish. But they want an Orthodox conversion. They come to an Orthodox Beit Din. They need to be able to live an Orthodox life. So we worked with them that way. Let's talk. We're going till when? Just so I can
Roughly 4:30, but we can.
Okay, so I want to spend a minute. I have some more good stories, but I want to talk about one significant case.
You can definitely tell the stories.
All right, well, I want to talk one other type of case, then I'll go to some of the stories. That's the case of where there's a significant other. These kind of end up being three types of cases. A non-Jew who is dating a Jew. A non-Jew who is engaged to a Jew. And a non-Jew who's married to a Jew, already in a family. Three different cases. Not completely different, but three different categories. So what we would do in the case of someone who is dating is we would not force them to break up. That was not what we would do. We would tell them, do not grow the relationship while you're in process. In other words, don't you can see each other, but don't go further. Don't go further in the relationship. Don't get more serious with each other while this is still happening. We cannot support that. And if the couple was living with each other at this stage, we'd say, you know, as long as you're living together, you know, we can't. We didn't make it a demand to separate at the very early stages. In other words, if everything was in place, and we had couples, especially in this Lakeview neighborhood, which is this big swinging singles neighborhood, there were couples who were living together, and one was a Jew, and they were thinking about getting married, but keep in mind, in many parts of the world, including the U.S., living together doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get married. So there's no issue of gayrus for marriage yet, necessarily, because we don't know that's going to happen. Maybe, maybe not. So at some point, we would force them to separate, but it didn't necessarily have to be the first stage. We wanted to see how else this would develop. And there would come an appropriate point somewhere in the middle where we'd say, you know something? If you're living halachic life, you can't live together. That's it. Part of the acceptance of mitzvot is that, you know, living together, sex is part of a marital framework. And that's, if you're accepting it, that's part of the acceptance too. And we sort, you know, when you're ready to do that, we'll be ready for you too. We often tossed things back to them. We didn't hit them over the head. We didn't, you know, yell at them. We basically told them what we expected from them, and when they were ready to walk through the door, we would be ready to greet them at the other side when they were ready for each step of the way. And when the sponsoring rabbi told us they're ready for the second meeting, we'd be ready for them too. But in a case where there's a Jewish party, that kind of skews things. So we didn't want them to get more serious while they were simply going with each other. Okay? If they were engaged, we had to ascertain, did they see conversion as a formality so the marriage is kosher, or were they serious about it? We did not demand they break up the engagement. We did demand that they wouldn't set a date for the wedding, because we wouldn't guarantee it that they'd be finished. When they finished was in large measure up to them. We'd have to give it the heksher and say, we feel that you're ready for it, but their growth was up to them, not up to us. They would have to prove to our satisfaction that they had absorbed the knowledge, had absorbed the beliefs, and were living, were part of a community, and living a halachic lifestyle. If they could prove that to us, we would say, okay, then we think you're ready now. And the sponsoring rabbi would have to sign off on it, of course. So we wouldn't demand that they break it up, but we would, we'd say, yeah, don't set a deadline, an artificial deadline that you may or may not be able to keep. After you're done, then you can talk about it. The third category was a really interesting one. That's a couple who's married to each other. And this was actually some of the most serious converts we got were people who were already in relationships. Because they weren't coming from, you know, another planet. And they weren't doing it just to get married. They already were married. These were people who said, I want to have a Jewish household. They may or may not have known what it means to have a Jewish household, but they're a Jewish household. We can guide them. This is what it means. These are the books that will tell you what it means. Here's a Rav who can tell you, you know, can teach you about it. We would still make the same demands. In other words, it would still take about a year, sometimes longer, sometimes less, but we wanted to think that after a certain point, we're helping to save a family, actually. We often converted whole families. When there were kids involved, we'd convert the kids to if everything was right. The kids. Now, when there were kids involved, we demanded that they go to a day school. And in fact, Rav Schwartz, this is a case where Rav Schwartz demanded that they go to an Orthodox day school. Rav Schwartz would not accept people in a Solomon Schechter day school, conservative day school. Okay? Not everybody holds that. There was another Rav in Chicago, Rav Schusterman Zatzal, who also did conversions, a Chabad rabbi, but not a shliach. He was really a senior shul rabbi. He didn't make that demand, and some people went to him. And we accepted those conversions, but we didn't. But Rav Schwartz felt he doesn't want to be sending people to a conservative day school. This is a shita, and so we wouldn't. At the Orthodox day school, there are occasionally special considerations. In other words, if the day school, if there are special needs, the day school can't address. We understood that. Then we said that you have to make other arrangements that the kids get a Torah education, a firm education. Yes?
One more thing.
I'm sorry?
I lived in for a couple of years, and day school is more expensive than anything else in the world.
Not college.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. More Ramaz.
Ramaz, yes.
Seriously, what about people who, you know, who couldn't afford sending kids to day school?
Chicago is an interesting community. Because Chicago, even though it's a big Jewish city, almost 300,000 Jews, and assuming that the Federation figures are right, that we're 10 to 12%, that's like 30,000 from Jews in Chicago. It's a big city. It's a big community. However, because it's pretty geographically centered, the Jews are from the north side, the northern suburbs. They're not in too many other places. So there is a sense of kehillah in Chicago that you don't have in other places. The other side is that we step on each other's toes a lot, okay? But because of that, if that was an issue, we didn't always find the money ourselves. We could help the sponsoring Rav sometimes find the money. They're generous people, and in fact, the Federation, this is one of the few federations in the country that actively supports day schools. they give large amounts of money. They put together, this is recent, but it just shows, Chicago Federation put together a $30 million day school trust fund. And the proceeds of that support all local day schools. So if there was an issue, we usually, if that was the issue, that was standing in the way, and everything else we thought was good, we would work with the sponsor to help them find ways to. And the day schools all give scholarships in Chicago. They're all pretty generous. They'll struggle. So we wouldn't want to let that become the issue. Look, even in our own little way, we charge at the end of the day $500 for the gay route. Okay? $150, that was the mikvah fee, which we have no choice about. If there was a real financial problem, we would waive our part of the fee. We would just say, you know, if we felt that everything was okay. The fact is, you know, if I were to sort of play the track out, during the first half of the process, we would, you know, not make it easy for them in a respectful way. Towards the end, we'd actually be cheering them on. We want them to finish. We would encourage them, and this is what you need to do to finish it. Okay? So if day school was the issue, we would try to help them find a way to make sure that wouldn't be the issue. It's a good question. But yeah, that was extremely important. In the case of the married people, so a lot of times we save whole families. I can think of wonderful cases, and I can think of whole families that converted. Part of the key when there's a significant other, and this is true for all the three cases I mentioned, is that the Jewish member of this relationship, dating, engagement, marriage, had to be as much engaged in the process as the non-Jew. This was Chok V'lo Yavor. And at the very, very least, the Jew had to be supportive of it. There were cases where the Jew was, you know, traditional but not 100%. So we didn't necessarily demand that they're both on the same, that they're both at the, we wanted them to be on the same page. They don't have to be on the same line of the same page, but they have to be on the same page. That the Jewish party should not be against what we're trying to do, and they should be supportive of it. And so Shabbos and Kashrus, Taras Mishpacha, which involves both parties, these need to be a part of the family relationship. So we'd want the Jewish party to do studying as well. We would make it an absolute demand, actually. It was extremely important, because that's part of the whole socialization relationship piece of it. If the Jewish party wasn't part of it, it wouldn't eventually stick. And I have this in my own family, frankly. My uncle, as you know, his second wife had an Orthodox conversion, but my uncle wasn't so firm at the time, and it didn't stick. And that marriage eventually ended. So I can speak from personal experience that if you don't have everybody involved, you know, who was Hillary Clinton said it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a kehillah to raise a Jew, and it takes to raise a ger. You need all the factors there in place. The rav, the family, the kehillah, the education, it's all got to be there for it. Perfection? No. We don't expect perfection. We expect a good job, a firm lifestyle. Yeah, we do, and it's possible. So thank you for bringing that up. I remember some of the best, for couples that were either converting as a family or the non-Jew was converting, we also demanded Chuppah the Kedushin immediately after the Gerus, often within the same hour or afternoon at least. And some of the most joyous moments I've had in my life were small little weddings that we did for such families. I remember one case where a couple came from out of town. We converted both parties in the couple as well as their children. And then there's a Sephardic shul across the street from the CRC offices. Mm-hmm. After the mikveh, we made the Mechuppah Kedushin. And we had some nice people who brought some refreshments. And we sang and we danced. I still think, wow, that was amazing we did that. We celebrated because they were becoming a Jewish family. We welcomed them. Their kids were going to a day school in their community. And it was all great. There were other cases where they were flying back to another city. And they had the chuppah in their other city with their home rav. Or they went back to another neighborhood in Chicago and their local rav did it. But we wanted to make it freilich. By that point, they've gone the route. They've done it. They have come under Kanfei Hashchina. Why shouldn't we celebrate with them? It's a wonderful thing. Yeah, Rav Schwartz always gave them a bracha afterwards. That's really important, by the way. There's a spiritual piece to it, to give them a bracha at some point afterwards. And when I did the paperwork, I was always very... I tried to be as spiritually supportive as I could to them. It's not just paperwork, but, you know, welcome them. So, I mean, that's pretty much the process. And if you have time for some stories, okay, I got a couple good stories. Yes, please.
Is your conversions are recognized by the chief rabbi?
Yes.
There's been issues all the time. Can you say a word about that?
For the most part, ours are recognized. There was one case that came up after I left the CRC, of a conversion that we did, and we think this is a young woman we converted, and eventually she wanted to go to a Haredi seminary, and they didn't accept our conversion. And I got a call from Nachum Eisenstein. I said I'd mention him, right? Some of you have heard of Nachum Eisenstein. I actually knew him as a bacher. He's from Chicago originally. He was in the base medrash when I was in high school at the time. I'm not going to say any more about him at this point. I could say a lot, but I'm not going to. He has sort of taken upon himself the mantle of policing everybody's gayrus for some reason. And he called us to yell and scream about it, and they couldn't accept. They made her reconvert in that particular case. It wasn't the Rabbanut, though. It was, you know, Rabbi Yosh, whoever he works with, Rabbi Yosh, I have no idea who he works with. I don't really care, frankly. But he was questioning everything. He was questioning me, questioning Rabbi Schwartz. I mean, I don't have patience for that. So, but for the most part, the Rabbanut HaRashit, yes, accepts our conversions. They've always accepted Chicago conversions. They accept Rabbi Schwartz. And now that we're part of the RCA's, you know, American system, so that's the agreement we have with them. That mean everything is put together nicely? You know, I don't know. But we are considered the official Beit Din of Chicago. And but, you know, is there craziness going on? I sense that there is craziness going on. So,
do you think it's going to get worse?
Do I think it's going to get worse? I hope not. I'm afraid so. I can only tell you that in terms of putting aside the politics, I believe that the system that I have outlined is about as halachic and as sensible a system as anybody can put together. It just, you know, it's a sensible system because it puts all the pieces together there. Yeah?
I was just going to say, the TV snippets about how people come to the Chicago Basin for, you know, the committee, after seeing certain snippets on TV, I actually saw so much of that in dealing with other converts during my own process and even after the process that I saw what I ended up calling the Fiddler on the Roof syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
That people saw snippets of Fiddler on the Roof and they thought that that's what they would get, that it would become like this kind of like fantasy world that they wanted to live in. Even so much so that one guy that I was doing the process with, who ended up falling through the gaps completely, he just went off on a completely bizarre, Derek, he ended up remaining non-Jewish, moving back to his hometown in Kutzlaret, naming his child, oldest child, Tevye, and his youngest daughter, Chaya Sara.
Say Chaya Mushka, you know.
He's still referring to himself as Tati with his children. Now he's got dreadlocks and, you know, lives in a little bungalow in the middle of nowhere with his non-Jewish, you know, wife. It's just like, someone could have been like, I mean, during the front, he was just one of these people who had this like TV snippet syndrome or Fiddler on the Roof syndrome, where he'd like seen a particular lifestyle and thought that that's kind of what it was all about. You know, it was like, you know, it was going to be like all the good parts of Fiddler on the Roof, not the second half of the
roof. That's an interesting story, and yeah, there are people like that out there who just get this bug up there. There's something romantic about being Jewish, and we tend to romanticize amongst ourselves a Torah life, and it's so wonderful. It is wonderful. For me to say not, I'm in the business of our bonnets, and I've been makari of many people. I'm proud of it. But the fact is, there are problems as well, and it's difficult, and it's not easy to shvirtz zayin a yid. It doesn't mean only with anti-Semitism. It means in terms of wrestling with living a halachic life. It can be very difficult, especially living in the modern world. And then there are the kind of yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Conservative conversions, is there any validity whatsoever? Is there a suffix? I don't know if even to ask about reform.
Can you ever go ahead and explain what they are? Like,
all right, for those who are not familiar.
Or when?
Okay.
What year are we talking about conservative conversions?
Okay, that's a good, thank you very much. Yes, I was going to say something along those lines. Let me explain. For those of you who are not North American, North American Jewry is divided into three major and a whole bunch of growing number of minor denominations or organized groups, let's call them. We would call ourselves Orthodox, okay? And within Orthodoxy, we know there's Haredi Orthodoxy and moderate, whatever those terms mean, and I'm still not totally sure of them, but we have some idea of what they mean because we operate within them, okay? Reform is what would be called a progressive Judaism in Western Europe and in the UK. It's liberal Judaism. And then conservative is somewhere in between. So reform basically does not accept halakha as binding. That's the major difference. They don't accept Torah Sinai. They accept the ethical part, though they will accept ritual and mitzvot if it's a personal choice. So in theory, actually, and I think I have actually talked to some very close reform scholar friends of mine who agree with me, you could actually be a totally frumi yid and call yourself a reform Jew if it's a personal choice, if you do it yourselves. What's that? There are people like that, yes, yes. So that's how you can have the thing. In reform, there are people more traditional. They'll dab mitzvahs and tefillin, keep a kosher home. Either reform, it's a personal choice. They don't see it as Maimed Har Sinai that is binding. Halacha is not binding. Conservative is somewhere in between, and the conservatives themselves are not exactly sure of their theology. They accept the general framework of halacha. What they do with Torah Sinai is not clear, and there are different opinions in the conservative movement. And sociologically, you know, the leadership is more observant and the laity is less observant, which is part of why the conservative movement in the States is shrinking, actually, because that's not a tenable theology. It's neither here nor there. Now, at one time, the leadership of conservative Judaism was very close to orthodoxy. So at one time, going back to the 40s and 50s, conservative gittin were actually accepted in Orthodox Bat Din. Because they were the gittin of Professor Boaz Cohen in the Jewish Theological Seminary were accepted by the RCA. I know this for a fact. Okay, conversions at one time were very, very similar to Orthodox conversions. To the best of my knowledge, that's not the case anymore. Their demands are, you know, first of all, the fact they allow women to serve on Bat Din is egalitarian, and that's the main obvious difference. And I won't even get into why that is right now because that's not our topic for today. But you can sort of do your own research and see this for yourself. So their Bat Din wouldn't be acceptable by our definition of Bat Din. And their definition of the theology and beliefs is very, very different. And they don't demand the same level of knowledge or commitment that we do. So no, we would not accept a conservative conversion. What we did do, however, is we gave them a little bit of credit for going, you know, at some step of it. We wouldn't say, feh, you're a goy, even if, al pi halacha, they weren't Jewish. We would say, well, we give credit for making the first step, and now here's what you need to do for an Orthodox conversion. In cases where there was a serious non-Orthodox case, we would often use the term upgrade, to upgrade their conversion. And that's how we treated it. So we treated the fact that they came this far with respect. We still didn't accept it, though. We couldn't, because it doesn't meet halachic standards as we understood them.
Is there any suffix there? And if there is, does that have any practical ramifications?
I would say, as time goes on, less and less suffix. At one time, I could have said, there may be a suffix, there may be a possibility. Where the suffix comes up is not in issues of gayrus, other than the process that I just outlined, where we did give them credit, that they've learned certain things, and you know we recognize that, and they showed us what they learned. But in gittin, for example, Rav Schwartz did gittin in cases where there was an unorthodox marriage, or there was an unorthodox convert involved, and he would word the get to reflect that. Instead of ben Avram Avinu, it would be ben Hager. But we did do gittin in cases like that. Schwartz felt l'chumra that unless there was a case of aguna where he was more makil on it, he would do a get in a case like that.
Aguna, he would just say, okay.
No. In aguna case where there was a way to follow Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe holds that reform and conservative marriages are not legal marriages, al pi halacha. We wouldn't follow that wholesale. But to save a woman from igun, he would rely on that. He'd have to do research. Notice he'd want to view the wedding video. Are there people who look like they're from who ate him up there? He would look at it. We actually looked at wedding videos together to see. And if there was a way that seemed that it wasn't done kalacha, he'd say, okay, I can passel this and allow her to remarry in a case like that. But only in those selected cases, not because Rav Schwartz, while he obviously did not accept Reform Judaism or conservative Judaism, he respects the people who identify themselves, including the rabbis who identify themselves that way. He's often taught them. He doesn't hold from boards of rabbis, but he has accompanied the Federation of Chicago has a rabbinic mission that goes to Eastern Europe and Israel every year, and it's across the board, all the rabbis, and Rav Schwartz goes on this every year. So he sits and learns with them. He sits and teaches them. They love him. The non-Orthodox rabbis love Rav Schwartz in Chicago. You can ask them if you don't believe me. And so that's a very good question. And as time goes on, it gets stickier and stickier. But the fact is, in some ways, it gets clearer and clearer. As we're moving further and further apart, there really is less of a suffix in terms of mainstream conservative Judaism resembling Orthodox Judaism. It's less than it used to be, much less. So that's actually gotten a certain amount easier. Okay? It's a very good question. It's a very, very good question.
Two questions. One is continuation of this question. Another question. Question number one is, what do you do in cases of, there was some kind of conversion 20 years ago, we don't know exactly what kind of rabbi, we think he was Orthodox, we don't know exactly, do you require a reconversion? Gir l'chumra, or, and even today, since now there's the standard, gir standards and the regional batei din, what happens if you have a local based in a three qualified Orthodox rabbis in small town somewhere, or in chief rabbi of Yugoslavia, case I've heard about, that there's no one necessarily, the chief rabbi, it doesn't, the state of Israel will say, we don't know who you are, we meet you then, you're a goy. But that doesn't, that's politics, not halal. As far as in the RC has the regional batei din, does this come to say that if there is a befall, a conversion, are you going to accept it, or are you going to say, now that we've decided this is our policy, we cannot allow exceptions and we're required to reconvert, and where's the basis of all of that?
Okay.
The other question is completely off topic, is a different topic, is you discussed people who are in relationships, what about people, children of a mixed marriage, which is, in America, happens quite a lot, and in Europe, it's most candidates for conversion have a Jewish parent. There's a chokashvut in that case, or they're part of the Jewish community. They may be very active in the Jewish community, but they're not halakhically Jewish. They're not Jewish, but these are the leaders of the community. And
okay.
Is there?
Well, you've asked several different questions,
yes,
there.
I know.
Okay, let me see if I can tie them together a little bit and address most of them at least, because I don't remember all of them. Rav Schwartz, before the GPS system was set up, he used to do this a lot more. And I think Peshitta, he still would do it, but he's given up on that for the sake of the GPS system. Rav Schwartz used to write Ishurim for cases where he wasn't personally involved in the conversion, but he knew the Rav and something about the case that he could attest to the validity, and he would write an Ishur certifying that conversion. Now, that's part of what certain people here really didn't like. They would accept Rav Schwartz if his name was on the actual Tzuda, but they didn't like any Shur where he wasn't present for it. And that was part of where the yelling and screaming came up. Like I say, Rav Schwartz, I don't think, feels any differently. He's not doing tshuva for it, in my opinion. But he's doing it less because that was part of the agreement for the Rabbi to accept us, we've got to do this less, so he's doing this less and less. I would have no hesitation accepting Rav Schwartz as Yeshua. Rav Schwartz, to me, is a guttle of the first caliber, and I trust him implicitly on these things. I would have no trouble with it. But, you know, if we're agreeing to be part of the system, so that's part of the system. So that's one case. The second case is in cases of questionable conversions. I'm not going to get into the difference between Giur L'chumra and Giur Misafik, because I really can't speak to it. I would not give you good information on that, both halachic or operational. I do know that from a practical point of view, in cases where that came to the CRC, if everything else was in place and the people were living, you know, the life that we, you know, would qualify them for conversion, we would redo the gear without a lot of fanfare. I had one case, I remember, I had several cases like that actually, where people who were accepted into yeshiva high schools in the Chicago area from cases like that. These were all the people who were, you know, wanted to have an Orthodox education, and so they met with a committee, with like a small version of the committee, and we wanted to assure ourselves everything was in place, and we took them, we dunked them, we checked their bris, they didn't have tafas dam, we dealt with that, so we did it without a lot of fanfare. In cases of the day schools of children in mixed marriages, so I don't know.
Also adults, not only children. Somebody who's in their 20s and 30s, they're coming. They just want to. Not only, I'm not talking about your thing. I'm not talking about the minors converting. Which
well,
is
it depends. It depends. It all depends. In other words, if they're living a frum life, we didn't have a lot of trouble, you know, reconverting them. If they weren't living a frum life, that could be more problematic. Then we would have to investigate how Puzzle was the best in. Could it be possibly kosher? Could it be maybe kosher? Was there a suffix? That's we have to go. Sometimes they did a lot of homework on this, frankly, to see who was the best in. Was it a best of Orthodox and conservative? We had cases like that. if it was an Orthodox Beit Din, but it wasn't one that we would recognize, we could tell them informally that it's probably okay, but we might not write any shur on it. It all depends on what the needs were. In other words, did they need it? We would say if they had a rabbi of their own, they should go back to their own rabbi and have them write the Yeshua. If the rabbi officiate the Beit Din, we wouldn't possel it. We just wouldn't necessarily sign off on it because we didn't know. We didn't know enough. When Rosh Forst was doing this, if we could be assured by the rabbi of Gan Kedusha Kedin, then he might write an Yeshua. Nowadays, less so because of the new system. In terms of Ger Katan, I do want to mention this. In cases where there were Ger Katan from mixed marriage going to an Orthodox day school, we developed a separate set of protocols. Our Schwartz didn't want the CRC to sign off directly. We had to serve that need. So we had the local, there's a group called the Associated Talmud Torahs. It's the Orthodox educational system in Chicago. It's the only city in the country that has a separate Orthodox educational system. It used to be Talmud Torahs. Now it's all day schools. A few Talmud Torahs. So if we had the ATT put together a Beit Din of their own to allow this child to study in one of their day schools, and then Rav Schwartz would write an Yeshur based on that. And that's how he handled that particular type of case.
I realize you're reaching the end of the time that we all have. Maybe I could get you to say just a few words about Kabbalat HaMitzvot. I know this is not halach shir, but a little more. You mentioned just the beginning of Uziel and whether and then Schwartz had three traditional Shabbos, Kashrus, and Muftah, but as that's a big issue, especially here in Israel, and, how much? What was the practice?
Well, in the CRC, we wanted them to be able to live a halachic lifestyle when they walked out of the mikvah. That was our goal here, that they would know how and be able to do it. We wanted to be assured that they would do it. Does that mean everybody did it? I can't say that. I'd say we had a pretty high percentage that did. We did pretty well with most of them, but there were a few that at some point later they weren't firm anymore. All right? We have to be assured at the moment of conversion, not only were they accepting it, which is a verbal declaration, but that the tools were in place to be able to maintain that, which is why the sponsoring rav had to be involved, why there had to be a community involved beyond the knowledge and the beliefs. That's what we were looking for.
And what about intention to practice?
Yeah, we asked them. We would ask them, what are you going to do when you go? You going to keep Shabbos? What does Shabbos look like for you? What's it going to look like for you? Yeah, we absolutely questioned them. The third meeting, that was actually part of that's the main part of the third meeting we had with them. Assuming they could assure us that they were ready to live this life and they were prepared to do it, then we would say, okay, you're ready to go to the mikvah. That's how we did it. Can we guarantee it? No. We tried to up the odds as much as we could. That's how I did. Now the situation.
How you word that also is: are you going to go to minyan three times a day?
No.
You know, there's questions of: are you going to say brachos, brachu lishon
ha'achron? No. There were certain things we did not fuss over. I'll be honest with you. We did not demand minyan three times a day. For a man to put on towels till every morning, absolutely. Yeah, we need to be assured of that. Women covering their hair, I'll tell you to be honest, we encouraged it. We taught it. We didn't make it an absolute demand in Chicago. Somebody, Toronto does, by the way. It's an absolute demand. We didn't make it an absolute. We encouraged it. We taught it as part of the essence of tradition. We did. But we didn't say, if you don't, it's not going to happen. We never said that. Now, the situation in Israel is totally different altogether, and I don't want to address that, really, because I'm not living in Israel. I'm not prepared to speak about the question of the Russians, and I've heard Rav Riskin talk about it. And it's a whole, does living in a Jewish society count for some of the stuff that I, you know, outlined before? Maybe, but I will not speak to that today. Okay?
In Israel, I know a case where a woman came from Europe. She was put with an Orthodox family, which is why I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
She spent a year and a half spending Shabbos and Yom Tov with this family. She knew all the material. And in the end, the rabbi canceled her visa and sent her home. She found out that she was Christian. The whole purpose was whatever was political. Have you had
We had one case, I remember, of a conversion that was done before I came. It turns out they were Jews for Jesus.
Yeah.
And we pretty much posseled it, I would say.
But they did go through the ceremony before.
They did, I think, and we said it was not Kabbalah mitzvot when they. In other words, Chazur L'surah happens. People go back. But the halacha is very clear. If there was clear Kabbalat mitzvot at the time, then there's still a yid, but a yid who isn't from, you know. So right. it happens, you know.
Yeah.
It happens. But I remember that one case. We did investigation, and we said, oh, the Jews for Jesus. And but it was, I wasn't directly involved in that, so I can't speak to the details. I just remember the story. That's all. Yeah, there were.
At one point, dealt with a similar issue with somebody as well, but I knew that they were going through the process and keeping it very secret that they were still believers in Yeshua, and coming from a Christian home myself and being an evangelical Christian and even a pulpit preacher in a Christian church and then converting to Judaism, I knew kind of the steps and what the direction that the person needed to take. I knew that there's an active, what I want to know from you is that does the base mm-hmm. have a policy of making an outright declaration, for instance, there's an actual pasuk in the New Testament that says that, you know, basically it comes out outright and says that if you deny Yeshua, you know, you outright deny him by your mouth, then essentially you may end up in hell. Now, this pasuk essentially trumps up any card that these missionaries try to pull, because they won't do it. They won't say those words that I hereby, as a result of my converting to Judaism, hereby deny Yeshua as my Lord and Savior, and in doing so, you know, I will become Jewish, blah blah blah, whatever. Does the has your Beit ever employed any kind of terminology like that, or?
The line Rav Schwartz liked to use at all steps of the game, in other words, early on as well as in the mikvah, is have you detached yourself from any other religion? That's those are the words he used. The other piece of it, however, is the sponsoring rabbi has to do the homework. And I think the cases where we got into trouble, and there weren't that many, but there were some, I have to admit it, were cases where sponsoring rabbis didn't do enough homework, didn't do their due diligence. The home situation, the background. Because they come to us, we try to do as much as we can, but look, we have 20 people who apply a month, and, you know, seven of them come to the committee, and three of them, that batch will eventually come through. But I'm not a detective. We're not detectives. So the sponsoring rabbi who has the main relationship is really our key to that. And when they mess up, it affects all of us. And it has happened. It didn't happen a lot, but it did happen. So,
should we take another 5-10 minutes for stories, or do we have to stop for? Okay, so let's do another.
When do I need to leave to get into?
You're fine. You have plenty of time.
Sure.
What time do they need the room in here? 5:00. What time is next year in the room? Five. Okay, so you want to take like 10 minutes and tell?
All right, Let's see some good stories. Stories that I marked down here. I told you my Chabad story. I remember the case where I had a woman in an open lesbian relationship applied for conversion. And the sponsoring rabbi there, who was about as liberal as they go, wasn't sure what to do with it. I spoke to the woman involved, but we really couldn't proceed. Not Rav Schwartz's shita. Rav Schwartz, you know, is makil on certain things and machmir on others, like any good posek. His shita on lesbianism, unlike many other poskim, is that he understands the Gemara in Yevamos and Daf Samach Tes, I believe, Nashim Nistolot, as an Isur D'oraisa. Many poskim, I can't say most, but many see it as Isur D'rabbanan. You know, Mishkav Zachar is Isur D'oraisa. He understood it as D'oraisa too, and we really could not proceed as long as she was in an open relationship. You know, the fact that she may have feelings towards other women, I don't know if that would have stopped us. But an open relationship with a Jew, of course. I mean, we couldn't go further with that. I'll tell you one of my wilder stories. This was a real good. This is one of my wilder stories. A woman who had been in process for quite a few years, actually, preceding my tenure as director of the CRC, there was a whole thick file on her already. And she had a sponsoring rabbi, who was also her counselor, which is already a red flag right there. In other words, should a sponsoring rabbi be, a therapist? In retrospect, well, you'll see how it turned out. The retrospect became the reality in it. But in retrospect, it already was a red flag. But we never rejected her. But there were always issues. She also had a certain handicap. And she also had a certain edge. Like, when I met her, which was not early on, it was like a year after I got in, there was always an anger there, a feeling like of being persecuted. And yet she wanted to keep the mitzvahs, and she was actually quite knowledgeable. Because the handicap, she couldn't really be part of a community, though she lived in a very intense community. But she could hardly get out of the house. So think about this for a minute. This has troubled me even till now. You know, someone like that who is actually going the route, but is unable to socialize through no fault. Her head had a fused spine, and she couldn't get out. There was a surgery, and it was not her fault. But if it was only that, we might have actually gone ahead. But the anger made it difficult to proceed, and the fact that her sponsoring rabbi was, you know, also kind of had a bit of an angry edge too. And so it was a strange relationship, I got to tell you, both from the sponsoring rabbi's part and from the person's part. But what made this really wild was at some point, somebody forwarded to me a blog. This was in the early days of blogs, okay, in the early 2000s, when blog, of a blog that she wrote, and I think it was on one of these Gayrus websites, you may even have seen it, about, like, it was a quasi-fictionalized version of her relationship and stories with her sponsoring rabbi and the CRC. Quasi-fictionalized because it talked about Chicago, even though the name of the rabbi was somewhat disguised. But to anybody who knew, it was clear who she was referring to. I was in there too, by the way. So I sent this blog to her response. I said, "What do you think of this, Rabbi X?" He says, "Oh my God," he couldn't believe it. He said, "I can't deal with her anymore." So I went back to her and I said, and she wants to move ahead with this whole thing. I said, "Your rabbi doesn't want to deal with you. What do I do here? You know, I can't move ahead with this." I mean, there were people who didn't want to move ahead because of the edginess and the anger, because it was so crazy case, the craziness here. But in the end, we told her, if you want to find another sponsoring rabbi, you can. Well, she blamed me for thwarting her conversion because I was the messenger here. But what broke my heart really was that she used to sign her letters, her emails to me, you know, I won't tell you the name that she used, but it was something like, Shlomit Devorah Bat Avraham Sarah, you know, because she always saw herself as a conversion. And the last communication, she started these long, like 10-page letters. That was already a red flag there. Somebody writes 10-page letters to the director of the CRC and the staff member. What's going on here? Come on. You get 10 pages for me? And she signed it, you know, Shlomit Devorah Bat, dot, dot, dot. I said, that really broke my heart. You know, leaving that blank. But we couldn't process, if her own sponsoring rabbi wouldn't deal with her anymore because she went public with some stuff that she should have. It was very unwise for her to do this. You don't publicize this stuff online for everybody in the world to see, stuff that shouldn't be publicized. You know, it's a very personal process. You know, it's one thing to have support groups, and there are gayer support groups, as you pointed out, so it's out there. Nobody had a problem with that. But writing these accounts of stuff like that, you know, and putting all this in it, like, not a good idea. So I don't know what happened to her, frankly. She sent me one more 10-page letter, and that was the last thing, because I if she would have found another sponsoring rabbi, we might have gone ahead. But in the end, it was probably better that we didn't, because this would have been a problem. There were problems at every step of the way because of the edginess and the anger and the, you know, everybody, she had a problem with everybody. That's not promising for somebody who's going to try to socialize, even forgetting about the handicap, to socialize in the community. So that was one of my more interesting stories. The people who came because they wanted to save the world, and they could only do it being Jewish, you know, we sent them back. I had people who came. I had one guy who came to me from a far suburb of Chicago who wanted to convert. And he'd already done some reading. And he was willing to keep halacha. He wasn't living near a community, but he was willing to move near one. Turns out he was married, though, to a non-Jew. I said, "Where's your wife?" Oh, she's a good Christian. Hello? Does anything... I said, "How do you intend to..." I said, I'm going to be a halachic Jew. "Well, we're thinking of getting divorced." "Okay, look, I'm not here to break up your marriage, sir. Come back to me when you resolve this and you'll decide where you want to go. But if you stay in a marriage and your spouse is not correct, we cannot help you, cannot process you." That's it. Never heard from him again. Actually, I take it back. He actually wrote me for a while, but it didn't go anywhere, of course. So we had a case like, why would they even, what's the Havamina here? Why would they come to us for this? But they did, for whatever these reasons are. You have all these strange cases that we have. So it was certainly one of the more interesting parts of my life. And I haven't done this yet, but when I was finishing my tenure at the CRC, I went through all the files and began taking data. of the converts that applied and the ones that went through. And I still have this data sitting downstairs in my desk, you know, in the den down there, still down there, to see what were the percentages, why are they coming, how many were in intermarriage relationships, how many were coming from other places, how many thought they were Jewish. So I never actually tallied all this information. It would make a really interesting article, I think. I've just never had the time to actually do it. But someday I might. You know, 4 years at the CRC, and what were the figures we had there. But what I did was, my anecdotal information, my anecdotal response, is that, you know, one of the biggest groups are people who were already in relationships and thought they were Jewish. Not the ones who come from the classic paradigm of Geirut, which is coming to be Nichnas tachat kanfei Ashchina. That the majority were not like that. Of the ones who were like that, I think many of them saw something spiritual in it, and I sense that many of them were unrooted in other ways. They came from families, not troubled families necessarily, but some did, but families where there was a sense of unrootedness, and Judaism either could give them or actually gave them, if they went throughout, a sense of rootedness that they didn't have in other parts of their lives. That's my anecdotal intuition about where they're coming from. And I think, I mean, I really should write this up someday, because I think this would have it would be helpful to people who are in the field. Some of you are going to be doing this wherever you're going to be. It might be helpful to you. But so I'll close with that. And okay. Thank you very much for sitting listening to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.